Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Join me again for another episode of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen. It's turning out to be a brilliant book. So a book within a book, so to speak, because it has a little story of it, of this person finding the treasure of Arab astronomy written up in a penny bookshop, a shop where they're trying to get rid of books, and they put a whole heap of books in a box for a penny, and the person reads it and it takes it away. So this is not your mainstream academic source for this type of stuff. And indeed, this is a book that is held by book publishers, bookshops bought on bulk. These are large copies of groups that people can't normally buy or can't sell in normal bookshops. They're bought by these bookshops and given out around the world. And it's, see, a bit of a story about what are we doing with our life, you know, in terms of that we're so focused on the mainstream that no one ever goes into any sort of depth. And indeed, he has gone to some quite interesting depth. In general, got most of the stories 90% right. And definitely has expressed it far better than I could ever dream of expressing it. So you are listening to the words of a genius. Now, this is by James Joyce Ulysses. So apparently he's an Irish person, and there's a comment about Ulysses is that you can't really ever understand it. So let's listen to this quote. So the title is chapter 11, Eclipses and the Enlightenment. So we've got a telescope, we're suddenly seeing stars, we've got Herschel and all these people spotting planets and stuff like that, and he's Eclipses and the Enlightenment, trying to work out what's going on, and it's he held out his right arm at arm's length towards the sun. Wanted to try that often, yes, completely. The tip of his little finger blotted out the sun's disk. That is absolutely correct. It's about half a degree, and your finger's about half a degree. If I had black glasses, interesting. There was a lot of talk about those sunspots. Then, when we were in the Lombard Street West, terrific explosions they are. There'll be a total eclipse this year, autumn sometime. This is particularly Ulysses. You're reading it, and of course the people, the literary type are reading it. They're full of literary gusto, but, and can interpret stuff, but they don't really take grist of a lot of Ulysses. I'll have to read it. When I was a schoolboy, of perhaps 10 or 11, one of my masters would end his class by making us keep silent for a final minute. It was his way of showing us how long time could feel, and so it did. Those 60 seconds seemed to go on forever as we waited for the end of the lesson bell, when he would burst out like swimmers shooting to the surface. Some 40 years later, on the 23rd of November 2003, I waited for the moon moved across the sun high in the heavens, and I was standing with about 60 fellow eclipse watchers in the Antarctic ice 3.5 miles deep. Somewhere out from the Russian base of Novolavazulak, at Queen Maud Land, positioned 70 degrees, 8 minutes west, and, I think he means north, he's got west there, 11 degrees, 30 minutes east. The sun's masking was the last 1 minute and 48 seconds. Brief enough time, it would seem, again to stretch for an eternity. Only this time, I wouldn't want it to end. It's beautiful. My journey had started with a flight from New York City to Cape Town. That's strange. Where the decommissioned Lucia 76 military cargo jet waited to take us. The 6.5 hours to the ice strip in the Novo, the night before takeoff, our group ranging from Arizona professor of astronomy to a pole dancer from Chicago, realizing her life ambitions, gathered for a briefing on conditions at the base camp. There was a danger of being misled by mock suns, or sun dogs, we're told, mirages created by light refracted through ice crystals or whiteouts, like being inside a ping pong ball, the freakish swirls, compact violent gusts, which scoop up any object and hurl it away. These, however, paled before the current weather conditions. Roaring winds of 120 kilometres per hour, temperatures of minus 28 degrees, were making it too hazardous to travel. Continuous storms over the last 12 days had locked down or blown away almost everything that had been set up for us. Equipment left by the previous group was totally lost beneath the snow. Even two small transport planes were buried up to their wingtips. The sightseeing team had been unable to leave their tents for the last 24 hours. As the report forecasts, a second, even fiercer front in 2 days' time. An 18 to 30-hour weather break might give us a window to fly in, witness the eclipse, and lift off ahead of the second storm, but official advice was planning to abandon the venture. A chance-making Russian pilot... These Russian pilot stories are amazing. Said we might have a chance. Next to me, someone whispered that no civil aviation plane had ever survived such an attempt. Our pilot stubbed out one more cigarette. Well, I'm ready if you are. And so we went. It's amazing that the Russian planes have war emergency power. So this is... So obviously, if you're in a fighter jet and you're going to be shot down, you can actually go to 100% outside, 110% outside your range to escape blowing up. But if you keep on doing that, your plane will just destruct. Okay, we touched down in the bright afternoon sunshine with a few hours to spare. Back to Cape Town, I asked. This does not quite make sense because Cape Town's in the southern south. I asked one of our group, Carol, a violinist with a Scottish Symphony Orchestra, if she would play for us if we smuggled in a violin. She had a look doubtful but nodded. And there she is. She's playing for Solar Eclipse in November in Antarctica. So this does not make sense. This is just totally incomprehensible to me, this entire stuff. And that was how, within an hour of landing, the Stonefield rang to Mozart's G Magic Concerto, the Blue Danube Waltz, Elton John's Something in the Way You Look Tonight, and Maris' Meditation from Matthias. A couple I had christened the Lovers, a New York-based British businessman and a servette, dark-haired Parisian lawyer, suddenly emerged from our one tent. She was just purple slip and ski boots and tango to the tartan brace. Oh God, with their movements surprisingly sensuous in the cold. Behind them brooded an Illusion 76, and beyond that nothing but millions of miles of frozen continent. I think this is a miss at Antarctica, so I don't quite understand how this all works. Although a little wind was blowing by now, it was numbingly cold, about minus 22 degrees C. We assembled about 10:15 that evening and would remain in place, thickly muffled until 11:10 p.m. Through my perspective shades, I watched the moon devouring the sun. This phase took about 3/4 of an hour. Then, about 10 minutes before totality, great irregular alternating bands of shadow and vivid light began to pulse towards us from the northwestern star, like smoke rising from the snow. Patterns made by rays from the last points of the solar crescent interacting with the Earth's upper atmosphere. Just before the total eclipse, we saw great red flares bursting from the sun's surface at about 1, 5 and 8 o'clock. Our shadows grew darker and darker until the moon just finally pulled out the entire sun, and all that remained was a black circle hanging in the sky, set against the glowing halo like a giant sunflower. The horizon turned deep red, contrasting to the upper crest of the brilliant green. I took off my protective glasses. The sun was almost below the horizon now, and we watched this spectacular dance with the moon and the edge of the Earth. Slowly, the satellite... satellite, it means... from what it means a satellite means a quartier parted from the star, and the crescent reappeared. Oh my God. Overwhelming the corona and forming a beautiful diamond ring. We were the first human beings in history to witness the total solar eclipse from Antarctica. But only the last to witness of what remains one of the great marvels of nature. The latest. And while we looked in awe, we no longer did so possessed by superstition and fear. Science had not only enlightened us, it had learned to use eclipses for advancement, a revolution indeed. The tradition of pursuing eclipses in far-off lands is part of that revolution that began in the 18th century with the great practitioner being Captain Cook, the endeavour to frame. A grave, steady man, as Boswell described, he had become intrigued by eclipses while reading Charles Leadbeater's complete system of astronomy, which declared that persons being well skilled in astronomy may, by the knowledge of eclipses, determine the true difference of meridians between London and the meridians where the ship is then, which reduced in degrees and minutes to the equator as a true longitude at sea. That is true, that an eclipse, when observed, happens at the same time. Something that you can work out. And so that he did actually use eclipses to work out where Canada was, or that aspect of it. So he was sent up on some farting thing. Okay, here we go. In August 1766, he experienced his first telescopes of the Virgo Islands and Newfoundland's coast. He was lucky to see it at all, as the fog lifted only at the last moment. But he seized the opportunity to work out the longitude of Newfoundland. His calculations were accurate enough that his reckoning was only 3 miles off across the whole width of the Atlantic. His paper, The Royal Society, delivered on the April 1767, was so acclaimed that it secured him the official backing needed for his great voyages of discovery. Well, that's an interesting aspect of it. I think he did the Irish Sea, then Gulf St. Lawrence, and he was just, you could see his mapping quality increase, and then there was just an intersection of beautiful thing. Over the next 11 years, he would see the sun go out 4 more times, each time totally. On the 10th of May, 1771, off the Ascension Islands in South Atlantic. So that's on his return journey from Australia. On the 6th of September, 1774, off the New Caledonia. That's his second voyage up there. And on the 5th of July, 1776, from Tonga, being 12 hours ahead, the occlusion coincided with the eclipse of the British power of North America. How do you like that? The sun must have darkened almost as the Declaration of Independence was ratified. And his last, on the 30th of December, 1777, from a place he christened Eclipse Island off Christmas Island, one of the Central Pacific, about 4,000 miles northeast of Australia. Northeast of Australia. Now, this is interesting. There's a map, I think, not in this book, maybe even in this book, which shows Christmas Island in the wrong place. Is it here? There's a book here which... I really can't say where I've seen it. There's a map, and he's got Christmas Island in the wrong place. He knew from Tobias Mayer's Nautical Almanac, published in 1767, that whatever the sun and moon had identical coordinates, they would find an eclipse. By the time he was murdered, he wasn't really murdered, but I don't think you'd call him a murderer, in Hawaii in February 1779, he had observed more solar eclipses than anyone else in history. Because he actually sailed his boat to them. Excellent. The average eclipse lasted just under 3 minutes, and the longest ever recorded being in the Indian Ocean in 55, running 7.08 minutes. Because the Earth and Moon have to be precisely aligned for total eclipses to take effect over any given location, such events are relatively rare. A maximum of 7 per year is possible. Okay. Okay, I can't work that way out in my head. Considering five solar and two lunar and 4 and 3, or 4 and 3, a minimum consisting of two solar eclipses only. Within the whole solar system, the Earth is the only planet to experience such pronounced shadowings. The likelihood of witnessing a total eclipse from any arbitrary selected point is 1 every 375 years. An annual eclipse every total eclipse, annual eclipse is a different thing from it. Annual eclipse is where the moon is too close to us. No, it's too far from us. So it goes away. Is 224. To view eclipse at all, one must be in a narrow band traced by the moon's shadow at its widest of no more than 112 miles. The shadow moves at 1,006 to 2,011 miles, 10 miles an hour, which I suppose is, the orbital speeds are pretty much the same, but it would depend on whether it's an annual eclipse would be slow because the moon's longer away, but it's also see, I don't think it would matter whether you're up and down the Earth. To view an eclipse and all, I must meet and it completes its journey in 3 to 4 hours. Every part of Britain and Ireland has witnessed a total eclipse sometime over the past 2,000 years, except for a small tract at Dingle on Ireland's west coast, yet obscure island of Ballica of northern Belarus was darkened by two occlusions within 3.5 years. And a spot in the Java Sea saw four eclipses within 13.7 years, a region, whatever it is. I see five eclipses. Well, this is make me yawn a bit. So this is eclipses, but he wanted to talk about the Enlightenment. As the scientific view of the universe deepened and grew in influence, observers began to speculate, I'm still speaking, on a range of associated phenomena. On the 15th of May, 1836, an annual eclipse passed over Northern Britain. A retired stockbroker who had helped found the Royal Astronomical Society, one Francis Bailey of Inchburney near Jedburgh, described what must have come known as the Bailey Beads. Wow. Well, that's weird. What is it? Oh, that's his name, Bailey Beads. Just before the moon started eating into the sun, he wrote, and a row of lucid points began like a bright necklace, irregularly in size and spacing, formed around that part of the moon that was about to enter the sun's disk. Or, what he was seeing was actually the last rays of sunlight streaming along those moon's innumerable valleys and that present themselves head on to the earth at the moment of eclipse. But it was the suddenness that impressed. Was about to enter, or was it about to leave the sun's disk? I think I would say that. Its formation, indeed, was so rapid that it presented the appearance of having been caused by the ignition of a fine train of gunpowder. Finally, the moon pursued her course. The dark intervening spaces were stretched out into long black parallel lines adjoining the limbs of the sun to the moon, when all suddenly gave way. This left the circumference of the sun of the moon in those points comparatively smooth and circular, and the moon perceptibly advanced on the face of the sun. Wow. So it's here the Bailey beads before it enters the sun. I don't quite understand that. The same phenomenon has been described 56 years before at a total eclipse in Prescott, Maine, on the 27th of October 1780, but it was Bailey's vivid description that secured his place in poetry and astronomy. Next to come under scrutiny were two happenings that we had seen in Antarctica. Solar prominences that looked like reddish filaments or blobs of lower corona, about which are actually large accumulation of relatively cold gas suspended high above the sun's atmosphere by its own magnetic field. And coronas themselves and halos white light that appear around the moon in totality. Heaven's awful rainbow, says Keats' phrases, coronas were described as early as AD 96, the first term being applied in 1563 at the eclipse On the 9th of April, 1567, the great Jesuit astronomer Christopher Clavius reckoned that the sun, them as the sun's uncovered rim. Kepler disproved this, but only with even less accurate explanation that the halo effect emanated from the moon itself. It would take another 300 years to discover the light came from ionized gases that form the sun's turbulent outer atmosphere, the photosphere. They have three components: polar rays, which extend into space for at least several times the sun's diameter, and inner and outer equatorial coronas of long elliptical streams. Okay, well, that's right. So this is ionization along the field. So you've got the field lines going up and the equatorial ones. Now, long elliptical stream is that, concluded Mrs. D.P. Todd, the foremost amateur astronomer of the day. Delicately curving and interlacing may tell the whole story of the sun's radiant energy. If only she had known how insightful her prediction would prove to be. The corona's pearly light is less than a millionth as intense as the central sun's, so it can be seen only during total eclipses, but such observations tell us how the star behaves, whether whatever their distance to Earth. The past 500 years, scientifically prepared man has used eclipses to take advantage of the superstitions and fears of the less informed peoples. Now, that's true. The transit of Venus, people who went deep into Russia using the Tsar's bell, the Queen Catherine's bell, which gave a free passage, apparently, your sleigh. These bells let the go there, and the town erupted and thought that the people were going to cause demonic destruction. Stupid as you can get. Example of that are both real life and in fiction. During his voyage of 1904, Christopher Columbus was stranded while reprovisioning in Jamaica. Some of his officers mutinied, and Columbus met the men, loyal to him, and found themselves at the mercy of the island's Arawak inhabitants. What? This is amazing. Who refused to bring food, leaving them to eat rats. From his astrological charts, he knew that the lunar eclipse was imminent, so he waited for the fateful day and sent the message to Arawak that, in his anger, he would make the moon rise, inflamed with wrath. On cue, it began to disappear. The stunned islanders beseeched his mercy, whereon he retreated to his cabin, used a half-hour glass, sand glass, to time how long the eclipse would last, then emerged to declare God had granted his prayer and the moon would be restored. The ship was restocked. Well, isn't that a crazy, crazy story? H. Reader Haggard, Ryder Haggard, 1856 to 1925, put the same idea to use in his 1885 classic King Solomon's Mines, the first popular novel in English to be set in Africa. It recounts the adventures of three British gentlemen, the mighty hunter Alan Quatermain and his companions Sir Henry Curtis and Captain Good R.N. together. So Captain Good of the Royal Navy, together with their formidable attendant, Umpobola, searching for the fabled mines in the kingdom of Kagoland, where they soon found themselves at the mercy of the great King Tawa. Conferring his companions, the blunt-spoken Captain Good puts apples out of his own. Now look here, you fellows, isn't tomorrow's the 4th of June? Sure enough, the records, it records that the solar eclipse will begin at 11:15 Greenwich Mean Time, visible in these islands, Africa, etc. There is a sign for you. Tell them that you will darken the sun tomorrow. The intrepid quartet attempt to bluff their way through, but when the Quatermain rhetorically inquires of King Tala whether any man can put out the sun, the great chief laughs aloud. No man can do it. The sun is stronger than the man who looks at him. Quatermain announces that this is precisely what his company will bring about. And the next day, at the appointed moment, the sun starts to disappear. Haggard was more sympathetic than most of his contemporaries to African culture, and was, and as the anciently evil witch doctress Gagu, cry to the trembling multitudes that all be well. I have seen the light before. No man can put out the sun. Lose not a heart, sit still, the shadow will pass, but the dying sun sweeps her power away. Dark ring crept on, strange and holy shadow encroached upon the sunlight. An ominous quiet filled the place, birds chirped, and that's true. I've been to a few, one in Adelaide and one in Melbourne, and it's an amazing thing that when there is a total solar eclipse, the birds do chirp. It's night time. And of course, being the crow, it gathered stillness. A boy cries out, "The wizards have killed the sun. We shall die in the dark. The Englishman's power seems absolute, and the chasing king accedes to their demands." This essay will become infamous. It was fraught with scientific mistakes. The path of totality could never cover both these British islands and Southern Africa. There was a full moon the night before the eclipse, although solar eclipses can only come about when the moon is new, somewhat to the earth. Totality is described as lasting an hour or more. In later editions, the chapter was rewritten. The solar eclipse became a lunar, which is a consequent dimming of dramatic power. Hagar may well have inspired Mark Twain's The Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court in The Modern Man. I remember reading that. That was, it was Bing Crosby had that, a movie. Hank Morgan struck on the head with a crowbar as precipitated into the Arthurian England. It's 16th of June, 528, and the locals are again hostile, threatening to burn the hapless Morgan until he too learns that the solar eclipse is about to occur. Twain's satire appeared in 1889, less than 4 years after Haggard's novel was published in the US. But it's also possible that Twain pinched the idea straight from history. He has his hero explain, "It came to my mind in the nick of time how Columbus and Cortez, or one of those peoples, played the eclipse on a saving Trump once, on some savages, and I saw my chance. I'll play it myself now. And it wouldn't be any plagiarism either, because I should get it nearly 1,000 years ahead." Okay. The eclipse trick, arguably one of the central tropes of classical civilization. In 1949, Hedge published The Prisoners of the Sun, in which Tintin, Captain Haddocks, and Professor Calculus fall captive to the Inky Kingdom, which survived the modern world. The presiding chieftain commands the trespassers to be burned alive on a pyre lit by the sun. But Tintin realizes the eclipse is imminent, and with a crucial moment on it, shouts, "O God of the sun, sublime, whatever it is, Pachamac, display thy power. I implore thee, if the sacrifice is not thy will, hide thy shining face from us." The sun goes out, and the Indians run in terror, and you've got the Tintin. Gee, Tintin's culturally inappropriate. Let's see how I've got to go. I've got to go and pick up my son soon. During the 19th century, superstition, I don't know where this fits in, where the Enlightenment comes along. It's 89. I've got a full 10 pages of this. It's not as good a read, is it? Okay. During the 19th century, superstition was still strong enough. On September 1820, the House of Lords suspended its divorce of trial Queen Caroline for the duration of the eclipse. But it was usually among the less educated that such atavistic fears persisted, giving rise to visions and religious inspirations. In the summer of 1831, a God-fearing Virginian slave acted on a vision that saved him during the previous several years' darkening. On the night of the 25th of August, Nat Term and seven companions massacred their master's household, then ravaged several of other landowners' houses nearby, killing more than 50 men, women. The eclipse is a bit tenuous here. And children. After remaining at large for 9 days, Turner was captured, tried, and hanged, but not before he made this confession about the effect of the eclipse at him. "By signs of the heavens that would it would make known to me that I should commence the great work. Until the first sign appeared, I should conceal the knowledge from men, and with the appearance of the sign, I should rise, prepare myself, and slay my enemies with their own weapons." Wow. This is a bit weird. Simon Tarrant imagined that Turner might have experienced this in his 1967 novels, The Confessions of Nat Turner. I looked up and then to see the sun wink slowly out as it devoured by the black shape of the moon. There was no surprise in my heart, no fear, no only revelation, a sense of final surrender. Okay, there's a big start. In May, in May 1858, an eclipse passed over Peru, Lieutenant Gillis of the U.S. Navy reporting. Two citizens of Osma stood within a few feet of me, watching in silence, and with anxious countenance and rapid and fearful decreased flight, they were wholly ignorant of any sudden effect which would follow the total obstruction of the sun. At that instant, one exclaimed in terror, La Gloria, and both fell to their knees, filled with awe. They appreciated the resemblance of the corona to the halos in which the old masters have encircled their heads of our Saviour Madonna, and devoutly regarding this as a manifestation of divine presence. Well, thank you very much. The same year, Twain published a Connecticut Yankee. A total eclipse ignited a major new religion. It originated with an orphan Perut Indian born in Nevada around 1858. Adopted by a local farmer and given an unassuming name of Jack Wilson. Like Turner, he grew up a devout child, and in his early 20s he became a local holy man, impressing his neighbours with the wisdom of his utterance, and taking a new name, Wovolka. I'm going to finish this soon. Which translates as cutter. He probably had been a woodsman in his team. In late 1888, he fell critically ill with scarlet fever. An eclipse fell that new year, and when the sun reappeared, several parrots burst into the prophet's cavern to find him in a deathly coma. The very hour of his translation, Appliance's principal biographer, Paul Bailey, had been a climatic one. To be ushered out of mortality in an awful moment of the sunset had all pretense of the divine and new celestial intervention, and the critical suspicions, after ascertaining with a knife and fire that withers, seeing the lifeless flesh, that it was no ordinary set, they were ready enough to ascribe the sun's escape from the black monster as a high assistance of their heaven-born prophets. When the miraculously arrived, he told his followers that he had been carried away into a green land where the dead lived again, and prescribed a special dance that will summon up the spirits. Pretty soon the earth will die, but Indians must not be afraid, because the earth will become alive again, just like the sun died and came alive again. He promised the white race would be swept away by a torrent of mud and water. His people would become young and free, disease of pain, and the land would be fertile. Game would return in abundance, and the Indian paradise repossess the country. Okay, well, on this I'm going to see if I can remember where I'm up to on that one. And hit it again. Thanks a lot for listening. Such a vision was difficult to resist. In a matter of months, the Washho, the Bannock, and the Pitt River tribes were treading the slow measures of the white man called Ghost Dance. Apostle from Parit carried his message to Wapi, Kornu, Mohave, and even far off Navajo. No religious movement in history, asserts Bailey, ever swept with greater speed, more dramatic impact across the face of the land. It's rather sad. It sort of almost brings a tear to my eye to hear this. So the Mormon settlers were shuffling alongside their native brethren as the new religion swept south, east, and north. The Bureau of Indian Affairs Interior Department came alarmed, but they need not have worried. Vorek unwisely fixed the precise date, the year 1900, for its transformation. When nothing happened, the great movement that had been set alight in the eclipse of 89 quickly collapsed. By the time he died in 32, Walker was little more than a faded footnote to history. Oh. Such stories, notwithstanding, worldwide, they have been inexorable with changes in attitude. New mythologies have been replaced by older ones. Eclipses not only no longer arouse old awe, but now we use them for our sport. In the 18th century, cheating by moving a die with one's little finger was to eclipse. One on the Mississippi during the 19th century, it became a tradition to name the fastest boat. The partial eclipse on the 38th of May 1900 happened to fall on the US election year. The followers of the two candidates, the Democrat William Jennings Barron and Republican William McKinley, gleefully handed out campaign buttons which read, "Partial eclipse will be total in November," or "Imaginary eclipse are visible only at Kansas City, July 4th, a reference to the city where Bryan was nominated. In modern times, the word eclipse has been appropriated almost at will, with little regard to context. A word of nominate, well, this is a footnote for the nomination. My God, look at those Parisian women. There's a picture of Parisian women, they've all got the same hairdo. They're all pretty stunningly beautiful hairdo. How do they get away with it? Okay, this is Bryan nominated. A quarter of a century passed before Bryan renewed his involvement with eclipses again, unhappily, during the famous Scoops trial of 1925 at Tennessee. John T. Scoops, a young high school teacher, was charged for teaching Darwin's theory of evolution in violation of state laws that forbade any theory that denies the story of divine creation of the mantle by the Bible. I think, there's a fantastic movie with Spencer Tracy, and it's called, oh, I can't think, The Wind, something, You Will Inherit the Wind, or something like that. A fantastic book on this. Bryant had campaigned for the law and offered to give evidence for the prosecution. Arranged against him were Clarence Darrow, possibly the best-known defence lawyer in American history. In his withering cross-examiner Bryan, Darrow quoted the 7 days of creation in Genesis, showing that God makes the sun on the fourth day of creation, yet there is a day and night for the previous three. How can this be? Further, the same passage makes it clear the sun rules the day and the moon the night. So how did Bryan explain eclipses? The strain proved too much for the old campaigner. Bryan died 5 days after the trial ended. Now, They Will Inherit the Wind or something, I think. Something like that. It's a fantastic movie. It's just a great movie to watch. In modern times, the word eclipse has been appropriated almost at will with regard to context. The word which once argued world-ending, augured world-ending catastrophe is currently the brand name of a popular chewing gum. However, nothing can get in the way of the sense of wonder we still feel when under the actual shadow of the eclipse. Novelist, this really doesn't follow as a book thing. We're into Galileo, and now it's just everything's using eclipses. It's almost like the sun's over. I don't know what we're going to do in the next 400 pages of this tome. One of the finest descriptions capturing the sense of momentary contact when the full mystery of created things comes from Virginia Woolf in Yorkshire to witness the 1927 eclipse, with the first totality viewable in England for more than 200 years. The next day, June 30th, she wrote in her diary. Now, this, all credit to him, he has got encyclopedic knowledge of literature. Now I must sketch out the eclipse rapidly, very, very quickly. All the colours faded. It became darker and darker as the beginning of a violent storm. The lights sank and sank. We kept saying, this is the shadow. And we thought, now it's over. This is the shadow. Then suddenly the light went out. We had fallen. It was extinct. There was no colour. The earth was dead. There was astonishing movement the next, and next, when as if the ball had rebounded from the cloud and took the colour itself again, only a sparky, ethereal colour, so light, came back. I had very strongly the feeling that the light went out of some of the vast obsessence, something kneeling down and suddenly raised up when the colours came. They came back astonishingly, lightly, quickly, beautifully in a valley over the hills. It was like a recovery. We had been much worse than had been expected. We had seen the world dead and within the power of nature. Okay, there's a footnote here. Oh, yes, here. I know of no other recording so moving yet. The eclipse lasted only 23 seconds. Okay, Wolf. This is a footnote. Wolf would use her experience again in her essay, The Sun and the Fish, and once more in 1931 when she recreates her moment of rapture in The Waves, in Visit to Hampton Court, that marks the novel's climax. The scene beneath me withered. It was like an eclipse when the sun went out and left the earth flourishing in full summer foliage, withered, brittle, false. How then does the light return to the world after the eclipse of the sun? Miraculously, frailly, in thin stripes, it hangs like a glass cage. It hoops to the fractured by the tiny jar, like the spark there, the next moment a flash of dun, then a vapour as if the earth were breathing in and out once or twice for the first time. Then under the dullness someone walks within with a green light, then off twists the white wrath. The woods grow blue and green, gradually the fields drink in red and golden brown, suddenly the river snatches a blue light. The earth absorbs colour like a sponge slowly drinking water. It puts on weight, rounds itself, hangs, pendant, settles and swings beneath our feet. So the landscape returned to me. Well, let's do a little round of applause for me. I can read that. My brain is coming back to do it, isn't it? Or that may have sounded awful to you, but it's just such a big improvement in my cognitive rehabilitation. By the next length of time, doesn't seem to matter. I don't know what these footnotes are killers, aren't they? The experience is generally memorable. Isaac Asimov relates how. So Isaac Asimov is this famous 60s and 70s science fiction writer. What a great man. Writes how on the 30th of June 73, he came to witness the total eclipse off the coast of West Africa aboard the cruise ship Canberra. Oh dear. Canberra has been our capital city. Cruise ship was still transporting out POMs at this stage. What impressed me most was the ending. A tiny dot of bright appeared, the sun spread out in half a second to become too bright to look at without filters. It was the sun coming back with a roar, and that was the most significant astronomical spectacle I ever saw. The paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould, also like Wolfe and Francis Bailey, stresses the quality of suddenness. The sky turns off, as if the celestial janitor threw the switch. For the sun is powerful, a fraction of 1% of the sunlight is daytime, while totality is nighttime. The transition in a moment, the twinkling of an eye, in ordinary conditions, he adds, it takes several hours for a person's colour dissemination to disappear. An eclipse that happens in a flash, one moment there's colour, then it dies out in a rush. For the eclipse of 2001, Gould having ordered all his students to take time off to observe it, they journeyed from his Boston home, where the skies were shrouded by rain, to New York City to witness the fall. Later, he describes a remarkable event. Here's a quote. In the age of artfully induced full-body shake-me-ups, we hardly think that anything so subtle, albeit pervasive as the character of surrounding sunlight, should move our passions or even invite our notice. The sky did not darken precipitately over New York on May 10th, but we are exquisitely sensitive to the usual character of light. Even though we may not explicitly credit our awareness and not be able to state what feels so odd, the day turned eerily somber while sunlight continued to rain, and the people noticed and trembled ever so slightly, and noticed and stood as the sky, full of daylight, darkened, and several and the level of clearly non-existent thunderstorm. A woman said to a friend, "Holy shit, either the world's about to end or it's going to rain, and I'm sure as hell ain't going to rain." Oh dear, that was a bit sad. This eloquent person speaking, and then, "Holy shit." Now, if only my brain can actually fire up and write as eloquently as this. If these are unusual sentiments for a scientist, they do demonstrate that there is still something primal in our response. In John Updike's story, The Eclipse, a man wanders into the backyard one afternoon with his 2-year-old daughter to watch a near-total eclipse. Here's a quote. "I looked up a split-second Prometheus and looked away. The bitten silhouette of the sun lingered redly on my retinas. The day was half cloudy. My impression had been the sun was struggling amid the furious knotted huddle of black silver clouds, with an enemy too dreadful to be seen, with eager ghosts hungry as time. He calls out his elderly neighbour sitting on her porch how she likes the eclipse. I don't, she answers, adding, they say you shouldn't go out in it, and there's something in the rays. The last darkness passes. Superstition, I thought, walking back through my yard, clutching my child's hand as tightly as a good luck token. There was no question in her touch. Day, night, twilight, noon were all wonders to her, and scheduled free of all bondage of prediction. The sun was being restored to itself and soon would radiate the influence as blazingly as ever. And in this sense, my daughter's blind trust was vindicated. Nevertheless, I was glad the eclipse had passed, as it were, over her head. For my own life, I felt certain assurance evaporate forever under the reality of the sun's disgrace. Well, this is all literal mumbo-jumbo, so I shouldn't say this. This is eclipse. This is not the Enlightenment, as I believe the Enlightenment of Banks or Cook and stuff like that. Modern terminology has helped us understand parts of our own world through eclipses. In 1872, the first great scientist, Pierre-Jules Césaire Janssen, 1824-1907 star, travelled in Paris in 1870 by the Franco-Prussian War. Janssen had memorably hopped aboard a hot air balloon and sailed out over the astonishing besiegers south and ever south before finally coming down in Oran in North Africa and observing eclipses there, only to be frustrated by cloud. His exploit may have fired the imagination of Arnold Bennett in the old wife's tale of Sophia, one of her sister heroines stranded on the same siege. Her husband Gerald, like Janssen, escapes in a balloon but is never seen again, an exit unique to fiction. Isn't that, yeah, well, isn't that beautiful? The husband goes out in fiction. French balloonist are well worth reading about. Observed the eclipse at Gadda, northeast India, just before and after Tetela discerned a yellow spectral line in the solar prominences. Wow. So bright to indicate previously unknown chemical element. Oh dear, what about that? It would be sodium. Oh, it could be helium. The English astronomer Norman Lockyer independently arrived at the same conclusion, naming the presence helium, in the belief it was found only in the Sun. By 1895, it had been isolated and identified as a substance found on Earth as well. Further studies of the past eclipses had revealed repeated slight changes in the Earth's rotation and variation of spin rate. Fuck me. That's ridiculous. I don't know where that goes together, but the helium one is, so he's, wow. I thought it was absorption lines. He got an emission line. What the heck? I find this hard to understand. The preeminent scientific employment of eclipses, however, was made at the height of the First World War. Einstein had just... Oh, it's a beautiful... let's be interesting. Einstein had just published the general theory of relativity, part of which stated that gravity would affect light so that... Oh, yes, Eddington, seeing the curvature behind the eclipse, is just published the great theory of relativity, so light passing a major source of gravitation would be bent out of straightness. Although this was a radical modification for the ideas of Newton, it explained the phenomena that had long been troubled in astronomy, the discovery that perihelion, the closest orbital point of the Sun, of the planet Mercury, was processing slightly faster east ear than gravitational effects of the other planets could account for. This is really deeply confused. There are two things there. Einstein's argument that gravity was a field, not a force, explained this subsequently, making the discovery he wrote. For 3 days, I was beside myself with joyous excitement. It remained to be proved. In 1917, a professor of astronomy of the neutral Netherlands sent a copy of Einstein's paper to the Royal Astronomical Society. Isn't that amazing? I never understood how these two corresponded. Where it was read by the leading British astrophysicist of the day, Arthur Eddington, unpreoccupied by wartime duty because he is a strict Quaker. That's also good, but also his homosexual lover got killed in the Cambridge Yards, I think. And Astronomer Royal, Sir Frank Dyson, the latter, a specialist in solar eclipses, realised the light's relationship to gravity could be tested by studying the stars visible in the immediate neighbourhood of eclipse sun, where Einstein writes these would have their light bent by the sun's gravitational field and would show up in photographs, a slightly displacement of vision in photographs taken when the sun was elsewhere in the sky. A solar eclipse was due on the 29th of May, 1919, and Dyson, studiously ignoring the fact that he was trying to prove the theory that emanated from a great scientist in perfidious Germany, feelings against which ranked so high that less than 2 months after the eclipse, when the International Astronomical Union was formed, German and Austrian scientists were specifically excluded, won government funding for 2-pronged expedition, which sailed at the beginning of March, parting company in Lisbon. Edgerton's part will travel to the Portuguese island of Principal, of the west coast of West Africa, northeast of Brazil, further along the path of totality. That's interesting. Because the documentary Einstein and Edgerton doesn't have that bit. By how much would gravity bend the light? Einstein's equation predicted the light grazing the surface of the light would be pulled by 1.745 seconds out, twice the deflection assumed by classical Newtonian theory. What? That hurts my head. That really hurts my head. Newton is zero, but it's twice. Okay. A second hour is 3,600th of a degree. So one's dealing with the minute differences, hence the difficulty in measuring them. Before he left London, Eddington, his principal assistants, E.T. Cottingham and Dyson, talked late into the night. And Cottingham asked what would happen if the eclipse photographs revealed not Newton's, not Einstein's, but twice Einstein's deflection. Anything will go mad, replied Dyson breezily, and you will have to come home alone. Isn't that beautiful? But, so Newton predicted a deflection as well. That's just incomprehensible. It's totally incomprehensible to me. There's double deflection. I'll have to reread this. By mid-May, and this is the great thing of reading these books, you read blur, which Virginia Woods, beautiful reading, and it's great for getting your cognitive stuff up, but then you read this and you go, what? By mid-May, Eddington and his party were in place. When the pinpoints of 5 stars came to view, Eddington had 8 minutes to take pictures. I did not see the eclipse, being too busy changing plates. We took 16 photographs. Over the next 6 nights, he developed the plates comparing them with photographs of the same stars taken when they had not been close to the sun. In the first 10 shots, thin cloud, while not enough to obscure the eclipse, was sufficient to mask the crucial stars. But the next 2 plates were usable and quite enough to supply proof that he was looking for. That's a drama. On the evening of the 3rd of June, Eddington turned to Cottingham. You won't have to go home alone. The 2 sets of photographs differed almost exactly the amount predicted by Einstein. Isn't that beautiful? The next expedition won headlines. The expedition won headlines everywhere. Times declaring, evolution of science, new theory of the universe, Newtonian ideas overthrown, and judging the finding one of the most momentous, if not the most momentous, pronouncement of the human thoughts. I would actually agree with them. The New York Times added up the stars, not where they seemed to be calculated to be, but nobody need worry, for Einstein knew where they were. It made the 40-year-old physicist a global hero overnight, and was also the first major instance of restored international scientific collaboration before peace had even been signed. The episode memorably recreated in the opening chapter of Nicholas Moseley novel Hopeful Monsters, which won the Whitbread Award in 1990. Well, there you go. Eddington, 2 years later, would reconfirm general relativity with his own magisterial work on the behaviour of light under the intense gravitational field of white dwarfs. dwarfs. Isn't that beautiful? Celebrated by producing a pastiche of Fitzgerald's translation of the Rad Ahmad Kami. This is the one, this is the book that was about to be chucked out in a penny, you know, bookseller. Two verses run. And this I know, whether Einstein is right or all his theories are exploded quite, one glimpse of stars amid the darkness caught, better than hours of toil by candlelight. Oh, leave the wise our measures to collate. The one thing at least is certain, light has weight. One thing is certain, and not and rest debate. Light rays, when they near the sun, do not go straight. Okay, that's rather poor English. So he's... Well, it's really poor quality poetry. The rest of the scientific world rejoiced, if not so impishly. It was doubtful, reflects Thomas Crumb in the History of Eclipses, whether eclipse astronomy will ever again achieve a result of such cosmic apology importance. It has yet to do so. So this is a fantastic Ennington's eclipse. Why the sun should bend, I think, and I don't think we have light has weight. That is bizarre. Where does this sound? I can't believe Eddington would say that. Well, there you go. I'll put this out. And it's chapter 12 coming up. And we're up to page nearly 200. And there's 600 pages of this book. We'd have to be... We're a third of the way through this book. Let's see how it goes. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them and tell others. Thanks for listening.